It's Friday, November 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello. Coming up, the battle among nations for a common strategy against Islamic State. Divisions emerge in the United States over where refugees are welcome.
It is deeply concerned for Human Rights Watch that they could face grave danger at the hand of Chinese authorities.
Refugees in Thailand face dangers in deportation, and we remember a huge influence in music. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. French Prime Minister Manuel Valls Thursday urged French lawmakers to extend a state of emergency imposed by President François Hollande in the wake of last week's terrorist attacks in Paris that killed 129 people. He warned the extremists could use chemical or biological weapons. While bilateral relations have deteriorated over the crisis in Ukraine, Russia and France have now suffered Islamic State attacks, including last month's downing of a Russian jetliner over Sinai. Both France and Russia are preparing separate draft resolutions to be considered as early as next week in the UN Security Council to unite the international community in the fight against the Islamic State. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told an audience in Washington that struggle is for the future of civilization.
This is a moment, a generational moment perhaps, but it's a moment in history where we have to, all of us collectively, stand up and say, no, we're not going to accept this, but also we're not going to be intimidated by it. We're not going to be somehow cowed in our pursuit of daily life and of the values which drive us as a country and as people. As human beings, we've worked too hard and too long. After two world wars and through the Cold War and the creation of the United Nations and all that comes with it, and all of our efforts to try to carry values and interests that talk about resolving things through rule of law and living peacefully together, notwithstanding differences, and promoting tolerance, one of the most important words in life today. And one of the most important organizing principles of any decent society.
Terrorism expert Greg Barton of Australia's Deakin University told VOA's Victor Beatty France has been taken completely by surprise by last Friday's attacks because the Islamic State militants had gone off the digital grid in coordinating the attacks. But he says the French have quickly recovered.
It's embarrassing for them, and they were caught by surprise on Friday. But since the Friday attacks, they've had 400-plus raids and 60 arrests, 75 weapons seized, including not just Kalashnikovs, but also a rocket launcher. They've really worked very hard these last few days and had good results. They were let down by not being forewarned by intelligence on Friday, and they have to figure out how that happened. But they've recovered very well. There are some worrying signs, of course. They still don't have any clarity about what they don't know, the unknown unknowns. They don't know how many other cells there are out there, what plans there might be for them to activate. Of course, there's a concern it goes beyond Paris, beyond France, because the key brains behind the operation was Belgium, and that the Molenbeek district of Brussels is an area of concern, as it's been so much in the past. So maybe Brussels could be next, but Germany is open, so is the UK. So there's a real sense of anxiety about that. The fact that that Syrian passport was found at one of the attack sites cannot be coincidental. I don't think a suicide bomber would accidentally take their passport into the field with them. I think it was done quite deliberately for us to find. I think that Islamic State wants to mess with the idea in European political thinking that migration is dangerous and it can't be controlled, and that amongst the refugees there will be terrorists. That's, of course, a very powerful nightmare to invoke. We've seen its impact on the US already. It seems remarkable how quickly it's taken hold.
The scope of the Islamic State reach now beyond Iraq and Syria, the AP writes, and yet despite all the airstrikes over the past year plus, the Paris attack showed the group is now acting on global ambitions. It has withstood the aerial pounding by US and coalition warplanes, defended its core territories, and apparently used its resiliency and social media savvy to replenish its ranks as quickly as they're reduced.
So far, all that is true. I mean, it will only know in hindsight where they're overreaching. They appear to be deliberately provoking anger, outrage. They're doing outrageous things to get us angry and outraged. But it appears that what they're trying to achieve from that is to encourage us into a long ground campaign. Now, I suppose you'd have to acknowledge that's not entirely foolish from their point of view, because long ground campaigns have been our undoing in Afghanistan and Iraq. But this may be an inflection point for them. If we can see a solution to the civil war in Syria through negotiation, and if we see a future Syrian government work with militia groups and the Syrian military to fight Islamic State on the ground in Syria, but Syrians taking back Syrian towns and cities, then this might be the point at which the tide turns against Islamic State. But they are conscious that this new wave of global directed attacks, mass casualty attacks, help strengthen or maintain their brand power and help keep the flow of recruits coming.
Greg Barton says the multinational air campaign against Islamic State cannot succeed without a Peshmerga-type ground force, and none of the rival forces fighting in Syria is strong enough to prevail, leaving a political solution as the only way to bring the global Islamic State threat to an end. Well, we turn now to our social media segment with International Edition's G. Abby Lee joining me here in Studio 22. And we're going to talk about a rather interesting survey from the organization known as Freddie Mac and how people are responding to it. Hello, G.
Hi there.
So what does the latest survey say?
Jim, the biggest takeaway is that 66% of the surveyed renters carry debt each month. On top of that, it showed 56% of the surveyed renters are optimistic about managing their debt. Also worth noting is that they're saving money for other priorities, but not a down payment on a home, which used to be the biggest chunk of saving for many Americans. A lot of people are sharing this story online because this means the great American dream of owning a home is slowly dying. The idea that home ownership is a linchpin of the American dream has actually been changing for the past couple of years.
Well, debt is a big issue. If people are not putting money aside for a down payment on a home, what are they saving for?
The biggest percentage of the renters, 59% that is, said saving for an emergency fund is their biggest priority. Other priorities that were higher than saving for a down payment was saving for retirement and children's education. Only 39% said saving for a down payment is their biggest priority. And I also want to note that many renters answer they're behind in saving the above items anyways.
So what's behind this trend?
Great question. This is how Freddie Mac explained the phenomenon. Rents are rising faster than incomes. And the latest data shows many renters don't have enough to pay all their debts each month, so they're forced to make trade-offs like cutting spending on other items, including mortgages. Jim, the fact that almost 60% of the surveyed renters are still optimistic about managing their finances, although they're carrying debt each month, goes to show how little people understand about the power of compounding interest.
A great concept. We might want to talk about that importance of it before you go.
Absolutely. So compound interest is the interest added to the principal of a deposit or loan. That means the longer people wait to pay off debt, the more it's going to cost them down the road. So you really want to get the debt monkey off your back first before saving for anything else. Jim?
Absolutely. Well, we always have great interest in what the social media trends are and what you find for us online. G. Abby Lee joins us each and every day here on International Edition in Studio 22, and she tweets for our VOA account. You can find her at VOA_IE and on her own account at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Just a short time ago, the U.S. House of Representatives, in a 289-137 vote, has passed a measure that would make it even harder for refugees from Syria and Iraq to enter the United States. The bill was pushed through Thursday by Republican leadership and would only allow refugees from those countries to come in after personal approval from top national security officials. It comes in the wake of that deadly terrorist attack in Paris a week ago. Some 47 Democrats also voted in favor of the bill, and the vote came very close to achieving enough votes, 290, to override a presidential veto, which the White House has threatened. Meanwhile, in the Senate, members of both parties say that the easiest path for foreign terrorists to enter the United States is the visa waiver program. Now, without visas, nationals from dozens of countries in Europe and elsewhere need only a passport to pass through U.S. customs at airports and other entry points, and therefore bypassing the screening process to which visa applicants are subjected. Several U.S. state governors have also said they do not want Syrian refugees coming into their states. In a conversation with International Edition host Susan Yockey, VOA correspondent Kane Faribault describes the opposing attitudes in Illinois.
The city of Chicago, city councilman yesterday passed a non-binding resolution saying that the city of Chicago will continue to welcome refugees, Syrian refugees, coming in. However, this contradicts the governor of Illinois, who earlier in the week joined 31 other Republican governors in the United States, saying that Illinois was going to be one of the states suspending the resettlement of refugees, Syrian refugees, into the state until the process was thoroughly reviewed and a more stricter vetting process occurred, among other stipulations. So it's not really clear exactly what the atmosphere here in Chicago or in the Midwest state of Illinois is in particular, because the city insists it wants to continue welcoming these refugees, but the governor of the state says he doesn't.
Aren't they concerned there in Chicago about this terrorism threat?
I think that there are a large number of people around the country who are concerned about terrorism, but not everybody, or I would say a vast majority of people that I spoke to, especially those who live in areas where there are refugees and immigrants, say these are people who are among the most vulnerable, the people that are among those most in need, and they are resettling because they are trying to escape terrorism, escape war, escape the threats and the dangers presented by those circumstances. And that's why they're refugees, and that's why they're coming to places like Chicago, where they can live a safe and protected life here, away from the violence that they were fleeing. And Suzanne Okres is the executive director of the Syrian Community Network, and she is herself Syrian-American. She's not a refugee. She's been living here in the United States for a long time. She's helping a lot of these families resettle here. In the past year, there's been about 130 individuals that have resettled in Chicago or in Illinois from Syria. That works out to about 16 families. And among those, she said, these are the most vulnerable. There are people here who are coming to the United States to seek treatment for illnesses. One family that's come here is suffering from cancer, so you know they're going through chemotherapy treatment. Another family, one that I had actually met just a few weeks ago, the Dado family. Azmat Dado has three teenage children and a younger daughter who is handicapped. I mean, Suzanne Okres, who's the director of the Syrian Community Network, insists that the people that are coming here are among the most vulnerable. Many of them are single mothers with children.
VOA correspondent Kane Faribault in Chicago. Rights groups, meanwhile, have widely condemned Thailand's deportation of two Chinese dissidents who had been recognized as asylum seekers by the United Nations. Ron Corbin reports for VOA from Bangkok. Analysts say the decision further highlights China's heightened diplomatic influence in Thailand since the military government came to power in May last year.
The Thai government is again facing criticism from rights groups and the United Nations over its decision to arrest and send back to China two dissidents recognized by the United Nations and cleared for resettlement to Canada. Cheng Yifei and Dong Guanping were detained on October 28 after a formal request from China. The two rights and democracy advocates were sent back over the weekend of November 14-15. Jiang is a democracy activist and political cartoonist in Chengdu, Sichuan province, and had lived in Thailand since 2008. Dong is a democracy activist from Zhengzhou City in Henan province. He arrived in Thailand in September last. The UN High Commission for Refugees had earlier protested the deportation, saying the two men's claims of fears of persecution were found to be legitimate. US-based Human Rights Watch's Thailand representative, Sunay Pasuk, said the rights organization held grave concerns for the men's safety.
Again, Thailand violated its international commitment to human rights principle by sending back activists from China, two of them, and it is deeply concerned for Human Rights Watch that they could face grave danger at the hand of Chinese authorities.
The U.S. rights group, in an open letter to Thai Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha, said the government had breached international law by deporting the men, calling the sending back cruel and alarming. But these charges were dismissed by Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Li, who said the issue had been handled in accordance with law. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
The music world has lost a giant. Alan Toussaint died last week after a performance in Spain. If you are not familiar with the name, you are likely very familiar with his music and the sounds he inspired. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald drops by our studio with more.
What more is there to say? After I've said I'm sorry.
We did experience a big loss, Jim. His name was Alan Toussaint. He was a singer, he was a songwriter, he was a producer, and he was a cultural ambassador for the city of New Orleans. He was born and raised there, and he was a major musical presence for six decades. He died on November 9th of an apparent heart attack just hours after performing in Madrid, Spain. He was 77.
How can we just end something that has been so much more good than bad?
Alan grew up in New Orleans. As a child, he learned to play piano in the syncopated style of Professor Longhair. And this was a distinctly New Orleans sound. And in the 1960s, he became a successful songwriter and producer in New Orleans, and some of his early hits include some pretty early rock classics like Mother-in-Law by Ernie K. Doe, Working in the Coal Mine by Lee Dorsey, the song Fortune Teller, which has been covered by many acts, including the Rolling Stones early in their career. And then in 1977, Glen Campbell had a number one hit in pop, country, and adult contemporary with a song of Alan's called Southern Nights.
Southern Nights. Have you ever felt a Southern Night?
He also recorded a series of solo albums in the 70s, although he said he was always more comfortable behind the scenes. He started working with artists outside the New Orleans orbit, which took his career to the next level. He arranged horns for the band. He worked with the group La Belle. He produced their signature hit, Lady Marmalade.
Your Lady Marmalade.
collaborated with Paul McCartney in Wings. And in recent years, hip-hop artists have sampled his work, introducing him to a whole new generation. In 2006, he released an album called The River in Reverse, which was a collaboration with Elvis Costello. Alan Toussaint became a cultural ambassador for New Orleans. He entered the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1998. And just 2 years ago, in 2013, President Barack Obama awarded him the National Medal of Arts. So this is a loss that the music world is feeling keenly.
He had deep roots, to say the least. Fortunately, we have all the recordings to listen to. One of the greats in music history and one of the greats here at VOA, counting down the top 20.
Every Thursday, right here on VOA.
Can't wait. Thanks so much for being with us, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
You've been listening to International Edition. We're at our website each and every day, voanews.com, and you can stop by there to catch our program and all the other great news and information available to you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We're also on Twitter. Follow us at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, our engineer, Dan Crafton. We thank them both profusely. And you for joining us. We hope you come back and visit with us again. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have yourself a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 years ago, Burma's president Thein Sein and the ruling regime launched a series of reforms and relaxed press and internet censorship laws that opened the door to democratization. The government also released from house arrest Aung San Suu Kyi, the leader of the main opposition party, the National League for Democracy, or NLD. On November 8th, these reforms were put to their most difficult test yet, as the Burmese people went to the polls to vote in a competitive general election with over 6,000 candidates vying for more than 1,100 parliamentary seats. Election results show the NLD winning over 75% of parliamentary seats nationwide, including enough to control both houses of the legislature. The United States has been very focused on this election, said White House Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes. It is a critical milestone in evaluating Burma's democratic transition. The United States participated, along with many international monitors, in working to ensure that the election was credible and inclusive, that there was transparency, and that it reflected the will of the people of Burma. 25 years ago, Burma held a similar election, but the sitting government annulled the results. This time, the government has pledged to listen to the will of the people and work to transfer power peacefully. The State Department also recognized structural problems. On November 8th, Secretary Kerry said in a public statement, "While these elections were an important step forward, we recognize that they were far from perfect. There remain important structural and systemic impediments to the realization of full democratic and civilian government." Rhodes summed it up by saying, "We believe this sends a very positive signal that an election took place. The people's voices were heard. The authorities are committing and pledging to respect the results of that election. Huge challenges remain in the country to complete the national reconciliation process with various ethnic groups and to address the humanitarian challenge in Rakhine State," he said. "But if they can continue in the spirit of national unity, this is an enormous opportunity for the people of Burma." The United States congratulates the people of Burma on taking this great step toward democracy and commends all of the people and institutions in the country who worked together to hold a peaceful and historic poll that allowed the people's voices to be heard.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.